You're listening to the Creepcast on DownrightCreepy.com. Now, here's your creepy host.
All right, welcome to the Creepcast. I'm Casey Canton, and joining me, as always, is Adam Roberts. Adam, how are you?
Everyone goes crazy whenever you say my name. Like the empty stadiums around the world just erupt in loudness.
Applause.
Oh, I just said loudness. Just like, well, they're like banging shit. They're clapping. They're cheering. They're ripping seats apart. That's what
like
they're doing.
A gladiator just came into the arena.
Yeah.
He's ready to tear some shit up. Hey.
What?
You know how we start these shows.
Okay.
We're gonna do it again today. Eventually we'll stop, but I feel like it's appropriate for this. But you know, I always ask how you're doing, and what I really want to do is,
well, do you want me to ask you how you're doing?
Please. I'd love for someone to ask me that. No one's asked me that lately. Well,
I mean, you make me feel bad by saying you always ask me how I'm doing. So I guess I'm gonna ask you. On a scale of Creature from the Black Lagoon to Cronenberg's The Fly, how creepy are we feeling today, Tim?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Adam. You know, I'm feeling a little bit like those creatures from The Descent today.
Oh, wow. Kind of like a blind Bat Boy, huh?
Yeah.
Wait, is Bat Boy blind by definition?
I think so. I mean, if he has the characteristics of a bat, then yes.
Well, he's got those big ass eyes, though. I don't know, because he is boy, too.
Yeah, but boy, maybe only in the since he has legs and arms.
I mean, he's half bat, half human, per the Wikipedia research I've done right now.
Just now.
Are you
feeling Bat Boy today?
No, I wish I was feeling Bat Boy today, but I want to talk more about Bat Boy. But I'll tell you how I'm feeling first, Tim. I'm feeling like the CGI creatures from Frank Darabont's The Mist. I'm feeling like all of them.
Goodness.
Like underneath this, a layer of horrible CGI is some great practical effects. That's how I'm feeling.
Well, that's, I mean, this might be the best yet, the best you've done yet, to be honest with you.
Well, that's how I'm feeling. I'm feeling like like underneath this bad shell of a human that I am existing as right now is a real Adam, is a real bad boy.
A real Adam. The reason I was talking about the Descent creatures is because I do feel like I'm holed up in this office cave that I've got. It's, you know, damp and wet outside right now. It feels like, very much feels like fall, which is incredible. But it just really fits the mood and the environment right now that we're in. That's why I feel like Descent. I feel a little wet. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like the wetness. I'm feeling a little
moist.
A little poorly rendered is how I'm feeling.
Okay. Was that what you think of the Descent creatures?
No, the Descent creatures are great. They look great. Very scary.
A lot of practical effects there. Well, I'm glad we got that out of the way. Again, kind of our therapy session, but at some point I need to talk to you more about this Bat Boy thing.
I'm shocked to learn that Bat Boy was only created in the summer of 1992, but I'm not shocked to learn that that was the second best-selling issue in the tabloid's history. That tabloid, of course, being the Weekly Worldwide News. Bat Boy today is a young 37 or 38. It's up to interpretation. But there you go. That's all the information I can tell you about Bat Boy.
All right. Well, we got that creepy feeling out of our systems. How about we talk about the topic at hand today?
It's a handful of topic I see in front of us. What is the topic today, Tim?
Well, you picked a film that we're going to review here in a little bit called Sweetheart. And I'll be honest with you, when you first brought this up, I did not remember it. I went and looked it up on Internet Movie Database. I remembered the still and the actress, and that's about it. I don't know why, but it really flew under the radar for me. So
I think for everybody, this was one. Absolutely. I think it was going to go theatrical. I'm not sure, but it ended up on Netflix. But we'll get into this movie because it's quite the treat. And I think a lot of people would enjoy this movie very much had they known about it. I just don't think people know about it.
Yeah, the interesting, well, we'll dive into it a little bit more, but it's, you know, it's from Blumhouse, so real weird that it didn't get more attention, because even back then Blumhouse was like really blowing up too. So but it deals with some isolation horror, you know, a creature feature, two really awesome things. So I wanted to bring up another subject matter that brings up isolation horror, and some tough decisions that have to be made when you get stranded somewhere, and how you react to those circumstances. And it can sometimes lead to some extreme measures and some tough decisions. So I wanted to bring up the plane crash of the rugby players that happened in the Andes back in 1972. Have you heard about this? Do you remember this?
So I remember the movie, and I would, if you put a gun to my head and said, "Hey, have you seen the movie Alive?" I would say yes. And then if you're like, "Tell me about it," and I'll be like, "Ah, people crash on a mountain, and then they are stuck there, and they're waiting for survival, and then they have to resort to cannibalism."
That's right, cannibalism, everyone's favorite topic. I don't know.
I
knew about this a while ago. I think through a documentary is when I first learned about it, but I thought it would be kind of fitting for what we're talking about today, because it was a group of rugby players and their friends and family, and they were on this trip. Old Christian rugby team is actually what they were, 1972, and they had their plane crash into the snowy abyss at the Andes Mountain in Argentina. And there's 45 passengers on this plane, but only 16 of them would survive in 72 days of the cold elements, which is insane to me to think about, that they crashed in October and the survivors were not found until December.
Yeah. They made it home just in time for Christmas.
Yeah. They,
well, most of them didn't, but some of them did.
It sucks. They missed Halloween, probably some toes, and then they came back for Christmas. So pretty somber, but an interesting story nonetheless, especially from the survivors, some of which are still around, obviously. And we're able to tell their tale through books. It's been in movies, like you mentioned, Alive, and numerous other things. But I had a quote here from one of the people involved, from Roberto Casnessa, about his experience. Would you want to read that quote, or you want me to?
Well, I certainly can. I believe it starts right here with, quote, this is Roberto's quote.
Yeah.
"Our common goal," well, it's obviously, I'm not doing his voice.
I wish you'd try.
For anybody keeping count, this is not, you know, an impersonation. This is not a reenactment. "Our common goal was to survive, but what we lacked was food. We had long since run out of the mirage pickings we'd found on the plane, and there was no vegetation or animal life to be found," obviously, because they're on a fucking mountain. And this is a side note. "After a few days, we were feeling the sensation of our own bodies consuming themselves just to remain alive. Before long, we would become too weak to recover from starvation."
We knew the answer, but it was too terrible to contemplate. So at that point, you know, desperation is set in. They have no food. No one plans to have to survive a plane crash for 72 days.
Yeah.
You probably have eaten all the peanuts that were on board. And you've turned to the land, which is all a snow-covered mountain cap. There's no vegetation. There's no animals around. And at this point, you've got some buddies, maybe not friends. Maybe you got some acquaintances laying over there on the mountain.
Mm.
Looking pretty tasty now. As a
popsicle. Wait. They must have had the ability to at least make fires, though, right? Because it was frigid. It was horribly cold. They at least had to make fires, right? Or they...
There wasn't really much left of the plane wreckage, if I recall the photos. So they could have taken some shelter in there. But that's still not really enough to survive 22 days. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. They had to have at least had something to start a fire. But, I bring this up because they ultimately cannibalized and ate some of their friends as the time went on. So
do you know if they, did they draw straws? Did they, like, how was it, whoever was, did people, did like somebody naturally die and they're like, look at that. That's some meat right there. Do you think that's probably how it started, right? So it wasn't like, let's decide who we're going to kill. It was like, probably people just started dying, right, from the ailments and starvation. And they were like, well, let's just eat that guy.
Yeah. I mean, I know that some people died from the crash itself. And then I read that there was an avalanche that killed a few more people. Mm-hmm. And then the elements
put them in the freezer is what they did.
Right. They started to take them out kind of one by one with the elements around them. And then basically Roberto and three other people, you know, they're freezing cold, they're starving, struggling to survive, stood over one of their dead friends with razor blades and broken glass and ended up cutting into him. The first incision was 9 days after the crash. Mm. And then they cut it into thin frozen strips of flesh and they put it on sheet metal. And then they finally started to consume those pieces after they just couldn't take it anymore. So yeah, I mean, it was a varying degree of how people died: plane crash, avalanche, elements, before they started to make the tough decision of eating their friends, which I can't even fathom.
Well, I could fathom it. I just don't want to do it raw.
You want it cooked. That's why you're why you're worried about fire.
Yeah. Well, if there's fire, it makes more sense. Like, I'm not going to eat regular raw meat. I mean, I'll eat like raw ish meat and I'll eat sushi, but I'm not ever going to just walk up to a cow and take a bite out of its ass. That's not something that's on my agenda. So, but what I would do is I would cook the guy who died that we didn't kill for sure. Absolutely did not kill him.
You'd prefer an impossible burger is what I got out of that statement.
No, I would eat the guy. I just need some fire. I don't want it to be raw. It's going to be cold. Like if you don't eat that body quick, it's going to like freeze, right? Cause the temperature is going to drop and it's going to turn brittle and gross. I don't know if I want to do that. You're going to have to eat him quick. I don't like this. Unless there's a fire, I don't want to eat this guy.
It's interesting you bring that up because I was going to follow up this whole story with would you eat your best friend in this scenario and how long do you wait before you eat him before you're like, fine, I'll just do it.
Well, if there's a fire, I think I'm going to do
pretty
it quick.
Quickly.
Yeah. And I think people, day nine, would I get to day nine? I don't know. I can get like 15 or 16 hours in a day without eating. And then I'm like, okay, I'm getting pretty hungry. I think day two, I would be okay. Like after not eating for like 30 hours, I'd probably be okay. So it's probably gonna be like day four or five that I start breaking down and like lose my mind a little bit. And then hopefully somebody was injured in the plane crash and they die. And then like day five, I'm already eating somebody.
I would, I think I would only make it like a day or two. And I say that cause I'm diabetic. I'm going to need some of that sweet, sweet meat to keep me afloat, keep me alive. So I'm not shaking, breaking down because it's already cold. Your body's already going through a lot to begin with. And I think I'm going to need that strength of an Adam Roberts butt cheek to really keep me going.
Oh,
so
you know, I got it, baby.
I know you're the first one I'm going to. So get that sweet piece of meat.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we can both depend on each other as sustenance if we're in this situation together.
So
something goes awry at South by Southwest and we're stuck, and we have to eat each other, or we just don't have time in between films.
Well, I think you were right to hear when they started eating their friends. So Roberto, who I did a fabulous impersonation of earlier, him and three other men were cold, starving, struggling to survive. And they stood over their friend and they had razor blades and broken glass and probably any sharp objects they can find. Razor blades, like used, it seems weird, like it was so premeditative. Yeah. So I'm just going to say they had shards of shit. And then he was quoted saying, "I will never forget that first incision 9 days after the crash. I just had to," or in his book, "I had to survive. We laid the thin strips of frozen flesh aside a piece of sheet metal. Each of us finally consumed our piece when we could bear it. Each of us came to our own decision in our own time. And once we had done so, it was irreversible. It was our final goodbye to innocence." That's brutal. pretty wild. Do you think he doesn't say, well, he's not going to give it away. But in these quotes you have here, he doesn't specify if people does indeed taste like chicken. And if he if he enjoyed it after he got past the initial hump of eating people.
I feel like everyone says that, though, right? Like that people taste like chicken because it's the one thing we can point at and be like, yeah, it's similar to this. What I mean, I've eaten other meat, and I think when you tell people like, oh, you've eaten crocodile or alligator, that's not a common meat, and you're like, yeah, it just tastes like chicken wings or something like that. They're shocked if they have never eaten it before, or if they don't like something, I mean, more exotic in that sense. So I think just all meat cooked the right way tastes like chicken.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. We're going to find out.
Yeah. Hopefully not soon, but sometime.
Whenever. Yeah. Next time we get on a plane.
God, I hope not. But okay, let's move into our movie review today. Netflix and Blumhouse's Sweetheart.
Yeah. Doing a little research here, I discovered that, so I knew it premiered at Sundance in 2019. What I didn't know is that it actually went straight to VOD last October 2019. I have heard, so that's shocking. It's been out almost a year, and I had heard nothing. I thought it was something that, because the quality is so high, the director, well, Jason Blum produced it. The director, J.D. Dillard, he did a movie that I like quite a bit. Another Sundance movie called Slight. Not a genre movie, really. It's about magic. Well, it's a little bit, but not really. Not like this. But this movie was great. It's, first of all, it's 82 minutes. It doesn't slow down. It's just a real nice, tight roller coaster ride that you're, when you see stuff like Fantasy Island, which was also a Blumhouse movie and released by Universal, that got a theatrical release, but this didn't. This movie
is insane.
Yeah, this movie's rocking a 90-something percent, 94% Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
I know you at first were like, I don't know, is it even horror? And I'm like, well, it's a creature feature for sure. What did you think?
Yeah, so I mean, the main reason I was wondering if it was horror is because when I first looked on Internet Movie Database before I went to Netflix, it said like fantasy, and it didn't actually, fantasy drama, adventure, I think, which is bizarre to me, that it would be categorized as that first, because it is a creature feature and it is horror. I don't really see fantasy at all in it because it's not a make-believe film, but it stars Kiersey Clemons, who I loved in the movie Dope a few years ago, 2015. It was one of my favorite films from that year. She's also in the Antebellum and Zack Snyder's Justice League TV miniseries that are both coming up. Antebellum's coming out, gosh, I don't know, this month, I guess, on VOD now. Is that what they've dumped it to VOD?
Supposedly that's what's happening.
So we'll see about that, but I'm looking forward to checking out that movie. But I really love this actress, and she has to carry this film. A lot of the first part of this film, you know, 20 minutes, maybe even, there's not really any dialogue. And it wasn't until after the film was done that it kind of hit me like, wow, she really carried a lot of this movie with not much dialogue. So I thought that was awesome. But you mentioned it's 82 minutes. It's on Netflix now, and it really is a fun ride. Like, you jump right into the action from the get-go.
Yeah, that was one thing. I put it on pretty late at night, I think around like midnight, and I was like, oh, it's 82 minutes. I wasn't feeling very tired, so I was like, whatever, I'll get onto this. And it went by so quick. It was nonstop. It really kind of, it reminded me in a lot of ways, because of its pacing, because the monsters is in the shadows and sound for the first like 25 minutes, quarter of the movie. It reminded me a little bit of the pilot episode of Lost.
Oh, yeah.
But the budget's much bigger. I think the scope is more grand. The Kiersey Clemons, she's great. And it just starts, and you don't need long conversations or dialogue or exposition here. It's just, some, you know, this woman washed ashore. She was in some kind of accident. She finds a friend of hers dead immediately. And then she looks on the island for stuff, and she finds some random crap and starts like trying to survive.
Yeah. Piece together things for her survival. I will say this thing, you know, it jumps in right away to the story. There's no, real setup. You kind of piece it together as you go along the first 10 minutes, what has happened. And the opening shot, the POV shot where we kind of emerge from the water as viewers and it reveals her body on the beach. I love that, because then as you go further into it, this being a creature feature, you're like, man, is this almost like the first time he sees her? Is this the first time we see her? But I really love that opening shot and how it kind of pops out of the water as she's laying on the side of the beach.
Yeah. It's that, I mean, that first shot, you're like, oh, you, they do such a good job of wrapping you into her character with no dialogue, really, that by the time that happens, I almost didn't, I fully didn't expect it. I was just like, so into like just her survival and what the hell she was going to do in this island to survive. And then that happened and it just shook me.
Well, and the only real dialogue we have is between her and her Brad. That's the one person on shore with her. And the only thing she really gets out of him is, did you see it? Now, we don't really know what that means right away, but it's some foreshadowing for what's to come in the next, 70 minutes of the film. And I love that too, that it was just this kind of hint, that something might not be right. And I went into this, I mean, I read the synopsis and kind of knew that part of it. It gives away some of the movie, but if you go in completely cold to this, oh boy, you're in for a treat, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, I don't know how much more we should go from here, because it's just, it's such like a throwback, like just simple creature feature. You don't learn too much about anything. You're just on the ride with the main character. And I think this, it all feels like it's pretty much in like a 48 hour time span. So it's fairly real time feeling, certainly.
Yeah. I think we get into about 4 days and nights, maybe five, when all's said and done, because the nights do progress. The days and nights progress pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
With reason, you start to learn more each day about her experience. But yeah, it's in the 82 minutes, they cover a lot of ground with storytelling, I feel like.
Yeah, for sure.
And I should say, if you haven't seen the film yet, by all means, pause this. Go turn on Netflix, find Sweetheart, watch it. It's a quick watch. Come back, listen to the podcast. All of Creepcast are spoiler podcasts. So make sure you watch the film first, then come back and enjoy and join our discussion. That being said, I immediately kind of thought of Castaway and different stranded, kind of isolated movies and how they tell stories. But this having a horror twist, we just don't see that often. And the story was way more, in my opinion, more interesting than Castaway. Castaway, it's longer. I know it's not a horror movie, but I'm comparing it because of the subject matter a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I just get bored with it a little bit. I liked it, but when you've got something like this, the pacing's so well done. And you learn just as much about the character and like some of the things you can piece together throughout. But yeah, the first night that she's there, she kind of wakes on the island. And but yeah, when she starts to swim out and see some belongings in the ocean, because she's trying to find ways to survive, she's finding some things on shore, but she sees what turns out to be a suitcase. And when she goes out to get the suitcase, which I would not have done if I knew that there might be something on the island with me, she goes underwater to explore a bit more, and that's when she finds what appears to be kind of a living, breathing hole in the ground, as another sign of something's not quite right here.
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is where things get wild. So up to this point, you've had a lot of strange things she's finding, but also nothing too strange for a deserted island, really. Like, you're finding like leftover stuff that's like either old or like not so old, which is kind of interesting, I think. But then
to capitalize on that point for a second, she finds a book bag of what we assume is a child with a scary stories book inside of it and a Game Boy. So the Game Boy is really a reference as to, gosh, this has been here probably for a long time, potentially, 10, 15, 20 years. If that Game Boy was new at the time with the kid, she finds photos of this family that was there. There's marked rocks with initials in it. And at the time, just makes you think, yeah, someone on vacation just put their initials in rocks. But we find out later on that apparently this family did not survive. And those were graves of the family, which, again, I pieced together a little bit later. Didn't think as much of it at the time. So, yeah, she's finding these belongings, some of which she can use. But then that suitcase that's floating out in the ocean is really what she uses to keep dry, change of clothes, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, the living, breathing hole that she finds at the bottom of the ocean during that time is the most important piece.
Yeah. I love the Game Boy thing. I love finding these things that keep her like sane. And it's just, the pacing is just insane that this is 82 minutes. Cause this is probably all done the first 25 minutes. And then like, okay, it's not even that we know there's going to be a monster unless you read about this or saw stills or anything like that.
Right.
It's just like, I don't know I didn't expect it to be what it ended up being. I certainly didn't expect to see as much as we saw. I thought it was going to be, I don't know, more of like her imagination maybe, or like her dealing with something else. But what we get here, because so many movies today do try to like have subtext and for whatever the creature or the horror is. And this, it's like, it's almost a relief in a bit, because the movie is so fucking good and it's so fast paced and it makes you care so quickly for her as a character. But then at the end, it's just a fucking monster story, and it doesn't try to be more than that. It's just about a survival monster story. We just don't get those very often. So I don't know, I'm guessing like 25 or 30 minutes is when we first finally see a shadow in the distance, but we see it, like, if I remember, this is the first time it comes out of the water, right? It, of the full moon.
Yeah. So she doesn't know it exists yet. She thinks something might be, it's at nighttime. She thinks something might be off because she finds a shark that's been just mutilated on the beach in the daytime. And so she's laying there, she's got her fire going, she found matches, you know, as part of the packages from a former group that was on the island, and she hears a plane, and in those packages she had a flare gun. She's like, oh shit, now's my chance to get out of here. And so yeah, she'll run to the edge of the beach, shoot that flare gun, finally gets it off, which I can't for the life of me figure out why a plane wouldn't have seen it, but it did go past. So, you know, it would have been behind it, but it's super bright. When she does that, as the flare comes to the ground or back into the ocean and falls down, is when we see the silhouette of the monster in the distance for maybe 2 or 3 seconds. And it's a fantastic like 20 seconds of the film.
Yeah.
Of, like, hope. And then, oh, shit, what's in the water?
Yeah, it's like, it's very, I guess that's like the most fantastical element, but it's such a beautiful shot and reveal. But then it's like, okay, we don't know too much other than it can kill stuff. It lives in the water and it comes at night. That's pretty much all we know up to this point. And then
the thing that I liked about it after that point from then on is that you got this psychological terror of, like, you know, every night knowing that you might be hunted by the sea monster. Regardless of knowing its habits, because we haven't figured that out yet, but knowing that it's out there, does it come out at night? Does it come out in the day? It just exists. You did see a hole out by where it is, so who the hell knows what's going on? But not only are you now trapped on an island and dealing with that, but now you've got this monster to deal with. So not only like psychologically surviving elements, but surviving a creature that looks just massive in the distance. I thought they did a great job of teasing that monster from the first time he enters the film, because it really starts to build the anticipation and kind of uses our own imaginations against us as to what's out there and what we see in the shadows in the distance.
Yeah. Well, and we quickly get to the next morning and then, well, into the next night, like, as she prepares to see it again. And then it's I mean, again, this is like, because this movie's so fast, we're probably like 35 minutes in when she has like a full on encounter with this thing. You know, it's storming. She's trying to set up like a trap and trying to get like a better visual on it. And then it's go time. Like, it's her and this like creature, and it feels like a very like man in suit moment, almost like a Predator sometime in the movie Predator. She's up in the trees and it's like she's just hiding, watching it. She can see it, but she doesn't think it can see her. And the lighting design is perfect because it's, you know, all woods and stuff around her and it's hunting her. And then, of course, all things go fucking haywire and she falls out of the tree and ends up having to like take shelter in a hollowed out log and stay there for the night. And that scene is just like, again, it's real time. Like we're just right with her and she doesn't have anything. Like everything goes wrong because the rainstorm. So she just hides and survives the night is all she's trying to do is just like, I can't defeat this thing. I saw it. It's fucking huge. I don't know what it is. And then she somehow miraculously survives.
Yeah. Cause the monster doesn't necessarily know she's in there right away. And I would liken it to, you know, like a bear attack or something and you're hiding in this log and it's scratching and clawing and knocking it around and you're just waiting to kind of be trapped in this wooden grave out here. And then luckily it just goes away. And we see as the film progresses a little bit that the monster is vulnerable. And that if you fight back, and I guess you could, now that I'm thinking about liken it to a bear, if you can fight back and hit it in some way, you know, you hit a bear in the nose or whatever is what they believe they tell you to do. It will back away and retreat. And it feels like this creature, even though it's big and monster strong, that if you fight back, it does have some vulnerability.
Yeah, no, I like the, again, I just her, did become so much of a battle between her and this monster. And she, you know, she's just a normal, she's the audience. She's every normal person. Yeah. And you know, as somebody who I guess may have grown up watching like a Bear Grylls or something, so she's got a little know-how to her. You know, somebody who's maybe been camping, or and she, you know, she's certainly like an athletic person, and she learns and adapts to just like fishing and things like that, and that helps her. All these things that she's learning in the first like 48, 72 hours of this movie help her in fighting this monster. But what's great is the twist it takes up to this point. So we know as an audience, we know we believe in her and that this thing is real. And then about 55 minutes into it, somebody comes ashore and she sees somebody out in the water.
Yeah. It's at this point we've seen Brad at the beginning. Mm-hmm. She's learned also that at night, if she feeds this thing, might leave her alone. So, you know, she finds a half eaten shark. She hangs it up as bait. It takes it, leaves her alone for the most part. We saw Brad come to shore. She buries him, but then another person comes to shore from the plane wreck or boat accident, I guess. And when he comes to shore, he's a half eaten torso already.
Yeah.
Bloated. So she uses him as bait. So we've had some additional survivors come to shore, but this is the first time anyone alive has come to shore. And it's her friend and her boyfriend, Lucas, which, boy, this guy is just a real dick, I feel like.
Yeah, this guy sucks from frame one.
And it's easy to, you know, immediately root for him to be the next piece of bait. And the friend's not much better, to be honest. But yeah, they floated in. And you brought this up. It's like 48, 72 hours into the movie. They're super hungry. But luckily, as you mentioned, Jennifer's adapted super well to her environment and survival tactics of fishing. Luckily, there's plenty of fish around for her to do that. I felt like she'd be a great contestant on like Naked and Afraid. very resilient, strong female character, smart. Knows the way around a campsite.
The Amazing Race or something. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And then this is when we get the human drama, because everyone just thinks that she's lost her shit, or she, you know, what happened to the other friends? Like there's like clearly some like past issues with trust of her boyfriend, this other woman possibly. And, it's, you know, for her, she's like, none of this fucking matters. Let's take your boat thing you got ashore with and get out of here right now. We can't wait till night. It comes at night, and the dickheads like don't believe her, and then they go as far as to fucking tie her up.
Yeah When that happened, I'm like, I'm done with you. Like you, I don't both. Care what happens.
Well, and you get like a vibe you get a vibe that they've probably like hooked up or are hooking up, right? And unbeknownst to our elite character,
yeah, it's something felt off. And it also, I never believed that Lucas and Jennifer were a couple It just didn't seem believable to me.
Yeah. Like,
the way he was acting, regardless of the situation, it just never clicked for me. But, you know, getting tied up, the flare gun, the log scene, you know, all these things, this movie has kind of these pockets of tense moments that get delivered in a really effective way, even if you know they might be coming. And this was another one, with the runtime being so fast, to introduce two more people and have this unbelievable story she has to convey to them, you knew something wasn't going to go right. So,
yeah, I mean, when they come up short, it just couldn't be that easy. And it isn't, because they don't believe her and they don't want, it's just, it's, it goes,
I think it's a fantasy that she's delusional or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. If there was any trust, issues that stood there before, they were the light was shined on them real bright when, she got tied up and then escapes. And then later the next day, they're dealing with the consequences of that. And he is shook because he sees the monster at night.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that she said, you know, is revealed as truth. And from that point on, he just wants to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, but it's too little too late at this point. And unfortunately, the monster, she knows how it plays, but there's no time to really tell them. And so both those characters die rather quickly.
Yeah, the friends walking on the beach, kind of just walking along the water, finds a half-eaten dead fish, and Lucas is still kind of over there lecturing Jennifer about whatever, tied to a tree. She's pleading with him, like, please untie me, you don't understand. And then while this is happening, the friend gets dragged away by the creature who comes out of the water. Lucas sees it, immediately runs to her help, but leaves Jennifer tied to the tree. So again, confirmation, I feel like, that something is happening between them and he doesn't give a crap about Jennifer, and tries to beat it with a log that's on fire, you know, a piece of firewood, to get it off of the friend, who, you know, doesn't matter. She gets pulled away and he runs back to Jennifer, who has gotten loose now because she kind of rubbed the rope against the tree until it finally broke. So she's free. And then that's when she has to almost console him as to what he's seen, even though she's been through it now night after night.
And tried to get them to be privy to it, and they just threw her ass and tied her up.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'll say this as we get toward the end of the film at this point. This is a creature feature, isolation horror, but let's talk about the creature for a second, a little bit further detail, because we never fully even see the creature until about an hour into the movie. And at that point, we really only seen him kind of in the shadows for the most part. And they used practical effects when it made sense. And when they even used the CGI part of it, it was mostly when he was jumping quick cuts at night into the water, out of the water. And you don't really, it doesn't really come across as CGI that much. For a film that was definitely low budget, the practical effects and the suit and the creature design itself, I really, really liked. And the first time you really see it is when they're underwater and you see him fully. So I like that aspect, that it took that long and it was more of like a drip, 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 kind of a tease, quick cuts of textured on the skin before we get that reveal.
I fucking loved it, because I'm a big Creature from the Black Lagoon fan. And this is like, this is like that on acid. And it is a man in suit for most of it. I mean, is that how you interpreted it? That it is an actual physical man most of the time, and then it's enhanced by CG, like when it floats and flies and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Like during any fight scenes, choreographed scenes, other than the quick jumps in and out of water, and potentially underwater, it seemed more practical to me. Yep.
Yeah, it's super cool, and it just made me excited to see something. And I think this would be an interesting take on the creature from the Black Lagoon as a remake. You know, we had The Shape of Water, which is kind of the classy, you know, Del Toro's pseudo remake. Sure. But this is probably how I envision more of a modern take on it. Like, this is fascinating. And you know, the sequel would really be what we know as Creature from the Black Lagoon, when she, if she ever were to get off the island, that they would come down and she would have this extraordinary story of what happened, and probably military research would find it, and that would lead us into Creature from the Black Lagoon. But this, yeah, the creature design was awesome. The fucking showdown at the end was so cool and so practical, and how she was able to, and it felt so much like Predator because she's using everything she's learned from the last couple days and its confrontations to defeat it. And did you love the ending? I thought it was just so great.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I liked most about the creature was the fact that it hints that the monster doesn't really have these supernatural characteristics like other creatures or horror villains. And during the battle scene, it's kind of confirmed, right? Because she's able to just stab him repeatedly.
Oh, yeah.
Ultimately, he bleeds out, or like she hits, you know, an artery or something like that, right? Or an organ that's vital to it, and it dies. And we saw that throughout the movie, where if you fight back, it doesn't necessarily like it and it will retreat. And to see not only like a gnarly creature design, but then also something that was rooted in reality was really cool to me. And that last scene pays off what we thought.
Yeah, the last scene is great. And I love actually that it's just a creature, and it's like of this earth, and it's not, sure it has an element of like, they can, it doesn't even fly really. Cause I think when we see it, it's done like cinematically. Like, I don't think it's actually flying so much. It is like,
yeah, it's just quick. It's kind
glide,
of floating.
It's kind of glide. It has the ability to like glide, I think, kind of like a bat or something. It's got like, I don't know. It's just
like a bat boy.
Yeah. Like a bat boy. But
I think that would go like characteristic of gliding underwater. Like a fish, in some ways it was kind of like that above water too, or it could kind of, like you said, float a little bit through the air, catch a little bit of air underneath. But I think it was just so big that it was taking these strides and fast when it wanted to be.
Yeah. It's, gosh. Yeah. The fact that it's not, I think, the fact that it is not a supernatural creature really, and that she is able to outsmart it and beat it, is just so gratifying and so fucking cool and unexpected. And it's done so well. And then the movie, this is like a very old school monster movie. I just watched Dracula last night. You know, those old school movies, you kill the monster and literally the movie's over. And that's how this is. It's like, she survived. She killed the monster. There's not another monster coming to her, although maybe there is somewhere, and there's not a helicopter or cops flying in. It's just, nope.
Yeah.
She's stuck in the island still, but she didn't die.
Yeah, the one thing I liked a lot about this is that, you know, the people that were around her during this time struggled with her telling the truth. And she gives a great quote before the final battle, because she doesn't know if she's going to survive. She might end up like these other people that have been on the island before. So she kind of reaccounts her experience on this island.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the quotes that I thought was great that they wrote was, "The truth doesn't always come with a receipt. Sometimes all you have is our word." And I love that quote, and it's so true. And then to have the final scene end the way it did, I didn't really know what to expect going into it. But two things I like about this is, one, it ends with her winning, but somehow still losing. Because as you mentioned, she's still on the island.
Yeah.
But yeah, you see the island burning afterwards, and a slow pan out of just endless, you know, ocean. And so it's weird that she beats the monster, but still kind of loses the game. You assume that she gets found because the island's on fire, and hopefully an airplane will see that. But I'm almost wondering if people don't stop at the island because they know the creature's there. And second, the second part of this is there another monster in the hole? Are there other holes? I don't know, but overall, I love the way it ended. And love the way that she defeated him. So I really enjoyed this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. Like, this movie rules. I wish more people would see it, and I hope this conversation increases that, like, the visibility of this movie, because it's just a incredibly well directed, great creature design, awesome lead performance that, like, for me, it was just a breakout of the movie. You know, she was great and dope, but this is her movie through and through. And she proves over and over throughout it that she is a badass leading star. And yeah, this is a must see, I think, for me. This is high up on my 2020 list. I know it came out in 2019.
I mean, it came out, but I mean, did it really?
Right. You're right.
When it came out on Netflix, you said it was in May of this year. I mean, people are going to discover it probably more so now than ever before, right?
Hopefully.
I feel like it could still kind of be on people's 2020 list if that's when you're widely discovering it through a release online. But yeah, it was great. I would give this, I teetered on higher. I gave it an 87 out of 100.
That's a great number.
I could have went higher, but and for it to be a low budget film, even though it's from Blumhouse and Universal distributed it, man, it was great and highly underappreciated.
Yeah, I gave it a 90%, 90% of 100. It's great. I mean, I love an 82-minute movie, and this one satisfied me and surprised me. And yeah, you always have my attention on a quick run time that like fires in all the cylinders. So
absolutely. Well, surprisingly, on Internet Movie Database, a 5.8 out of 10, which is just bizarre to me. From an audience standpoint, it was a 5.8 out of 10, but Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter was 94%, which is excellent. The audience was only 51%. So we're kind of setting at like critics versus audiences. Critics liked it more. Audiences kind of gave it a flunking grade. I don't understand why.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because it didn't get a lot of publicity and they just kind of went into it and thought it was wonky because it's derivative of storytelling without a lot of dialogue. It leans on the character so much. But kind of strange. I mean, I would throw those out the window and just go into this looking to have some fun, with a creature feature and you're going to enjoy it quite a bit more. Now I've got a bonus question for you.
Oh, for me?
Yeah.
All right.
This, you know, we've got this creature, presumably only the people on this island have ever seen before, unless somebody flying over knows about it and is trying to just forget that it exists and leave it alone. But we've got a creature, we end up killing it because we have to survive. But what if you could have caught that creature in some way? Would you have, or studied it, for instance? Would you have done that, or would you have killed it? We'll start with the creature in the film, but I want to migrate it over to something in quote unquote real life. It begs the question to me, if we found Bigfoot in the wild, you know, it's this mythical creature that kind of up to this point has only been.
This is you and I find, like, our plane crashes, you and I find Bigfoot.
Sure. Not even a plane crash. We're just looking for mushrooms. We're hiking through the woods.
Mushroom hunting.
Some tasty mushrooms. We run across Bigfoot off in the distance, like say 100 yards away. And we're like, is that a Bigfoot? It gets closer and closer. Now it's 50 yards away. In that moment, are you thinking, should we capture it somehow on film? Should we call someone to say it's here? Should we record it? Should we live stream it? My point is, do we immediately try to kill it? Because I feel like some people will do that. Or is this something that we would want to more preserve and capture live or study? It just seems weird to me when you've got something so kind of white elephant and rare that we're just like, we should kill it, kill the beast.
Well,
could go both ways. I understand both arguments.
At first I was going to kill it. And listen, I've only changed a little bit. Listen, I don't want to capture it, actually. Oh, shit. What do I want to do? I'm not a scientist, so I don't know if I gain anything from that. I think you... Oh, man.
Society might. Society. Well,
yeah. But what... Also, if you just kill it, though, and bring it back, you're one of those people who, throughout history, has, quote, killed a Bigfoot. And here's my Bigfoot taxidermy I've made.
Yeah,
I don't know. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. I might just let it go and take a photo.
I agree. Yeah, you're gonna take that blurry photo, or a real grainy flip phone camera.
No matter what you do, it's not gonna look great.
I feel like this conversation by itself is probably why it's never been caught, right? Like,
correct.
You just don't know what to do when they're there. Now, if it attacks you, you got to kill it. You know, you're not gonna try and find a way to capture that thing. At that point, it's a bear attack. But yeah, I always thought that would be an interesting question. What if you ran into a Bigfoot? What would you want to do? If you could you capture it? You know, put it in a cage. Not that you're gonna have one with you, but would you capture it or would you kill it and put it in your house like some dickhead? I don't know. Just asking the question here.
Yeah, it's a good question to ask. It's too tough for me to answer.
It's tricky. Well, that kind of concludes our episode for today of creature features and isolation horror and cannibalism on the snowy mountains of the Andes Mountains. But we'd like to hear from you. So please hit us up on social media. You can just hashtag us at Creepcast or add us at Downright Creepy.
You better add us.
We'd love to hear what you think of the podcast, good or bad. Rate, review it, subscribe to us. Listen to wherever you can find it, wherever you have your podcast, and you can donate to our Patreon and tell us, would you capture Bigfoot or would you kill it if you had the choice? But check out Sweetheart. Put it on your list of things to watch this September, this October for your Halloween programming. And Netflix just dropped a ton of stuff for Halloween programming that we've posted on the site. If you want to check it out, Adam, what do you have in store at Screenland and Screenland online for this Halloween? You want to talk about it for a second?
Oh boy. Well, we just announced our ninth annual Sharktober, which is 31 days of horror. Most of it is done. So there's just, it's, you know, we're doing inside and outside movies. So the outside, I'm going to be doing some double features this year. I'm showing the most, like pre-1950 classics I've ever shown, which is fun. And I'm pairing them as double feature with like a more modern film. So, we're kicking that off in the beginning of the month with, The House of Frankenstein with Monster Squad, which are, you know, House of Frankenstein was a mashup movie and has like all the creatures. And we're showing Monster Squad with it, which has all the creatures as well. So it's just a whole ton of films, new films, old, you know, classic films. You know, we'll have some stuff online and yeah, a whole bunch of cool stuff that I'm excited about. And yeah,
that's awesome. We also have Panic Fest Presents Tricks and Treats, a virtual online Halloween event that will be over Halloween weekend. And tickets are available now at panicfilmfest.com/tricks. You can submit a film, features, shorts, or a live event idea, or you can buy a ticket for only $30. It gets you access to everything all weekend long, to our live stream. We have some partnerships we're going to announce sometime soon and some live events, but all the programming, or most of the programming, will be announced in early October sometime. And it's not officially Panic Fest. It's just kind of a way to celebrate Halloween with our Panic Fest community and Screenland and Downright Creepy. I think it's going to be an awesome time. So please check it out. Panicfilmfest.com/tricks and look for more details there. Lastly, I wanted to ask about your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that a little bit before. What do you have coming up on that?
Well, I'm about ready to record one later today with old Eric Havens. Not old. Yeah, Nightmare Hour. So we're doing a month of cults. So we're talking about cult movies, real true crime cult stuff. And then we're gearing up for some crazy stuff in October. But yeah, all through September, this week will be the first one where we just kind of generally talk about cults. And then throughout the month, we're going to talk about movies, you know, like the Invitation. We're going to talk about The Witch. We're going to talk about, I don't know, there's a ton of cult movies and most of them probably people have seen. So, so we're going to talk about cult movies and, brainwashing and all sorts of craziness, both the reality of it and the fictional.
Well, it was always a lot of fun. Genius, and I from Nightmare Junkhead just started Super Creepy Fun Time Hour. And our first episode is us joining a cult. And we talk about, what our cults would be like. We're going to give everyone a cult worksheet online so they can fill it out and tell us what their cult would be like. So look for episodes of Super Creepy Funtime Hour and Black Magic Coven on the Crickets Podcast Network here on Downright Creepy. But I think that's all we got. So unless you got anything to add, maybe maybe rent a movie from screenlandonline.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Rent a movie from us. There you go.
All right. Well, until next time, thanks for joining us. And what is it? Stay creepy. Is that how we leave?
Put your creep hat on and stay creepy, y'all.
That's a good way to go out. We'll see you next time.
Listening to a Downright Creepy original on the Crickets Podcast Network.